Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the LA Steel Show. I'm Lila and Leo will be with us in a minute. Today we're going to bring you, this evening we're going to bring you some news and then we're going to play our interview from last night from our interview that we did on Q103 FM. 103.3 FM out of Lakeville, Connecticut. That's our FM show, which we have every Tuesday night. And we interviewed Marty Horowitz, MD, and he has written a book called A Course in Happiness, Mastering the Three Levels of Self-Understanding That Lead to True and Lasting Contentment. And we'll play that. I think that's about a half-hour interview. Here's Leo right now.
Good evening.
Good
evening, folks.
That was a pretty good interview, and it's a good book, and I think you'll enjoy the interview, and maybe you'll think about purchasing the book yourself. But before we bring you the interview, I thought we would bring you a little bit of news. And this, I thought, was quite interesting. It's from naturalnews.com, and this is a topic that interests everyone. It's on the swine flu, the H1N1 swine flu. Two shocking bits of news about the H1N1 swine flu virus emerged this week. The first is that the widely circulating swine flu virus may be a lot more dangerous than people have so far been told. It appears to resemble the 1918 pandemic virus in the fact that it is capable of embedding itself deep in lung tissue and causing deadly infections. This is very different from the more common seasonal flu, which does not replicate in the lungs. Explaining this concept, lead researcher Yoshihiro Kawaka of the University of Wisconsin wrote in the journal Nature, when we conducted the experiments in ferrets and monkeys, the seasonal virus did not replicate in the lungs. The H1N1 virus replicates significantly better in the lungs. As Reuters reports, and Kawaoka added, there is a misunderstanding about this virus. There is a clear evidence the virus is different than seasonal influenza. The 1918 influenza pandemic killed at least 40 million people globally, and probably many more. Also remember, this was a time when obesity was extremely rare. Today, obesity is alarmingly common among first world nations, and obesity is now suspected of making a person highly susceptible to swine flu fatalities. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization, always a trusted friend of Big Pharma, that means Big Pharma, pharmacology, or the big pharmacology firms, we know who they are, has announced that the swine flu is unstoppable and is now directing all the nations of the world to vaccinate their citizens against the H1N1 influenza strain. This is essentially an order for global mandatory vaccination. And get this. And yet at the same time, the World Health Organization is recommending mass global vaccinations against the swine flu. It also states in its own website that such vaccines have never been proven safe. So, in other words, they're using us as guinea pigs, and in this article they say, and to see who dies first. It is not difficult to decode the World Health Organization's language in this case. The vaccines aren't safe, so they're recommending that people given the vaccines be watched closely to see what happens. And just to make sure more people die, the World Health Organization is also recommending such vaccines use live, unattenuated influenza. So inject yourself with live, unattenuated influenza. What exactly is live, unattenuated influenza? It means live viruses that have been weakened but may still pose a danger to human health. Big Pharma, of course, is more than happy to comply with this order. They're getting paid billions to make the live vaccines. After all, notably, Baxter Pharmaceuticals has already been caught inserting live avian flu viruses in vaccine materials and other drug companies are only too happy to follow suit. But why, you ask, would government want to inject their populations with live, unattenuated influenza DNA? And why should the World Health Organization aggressively promote such a measure, especially since the number of swine flu fatalities so far is exceedingly small? There are numerous theories on that, and I don't claim to know the right answer, but here are some of the theories being talked about by people in the know. The population control theory. The swine flu was engineered in a lab, then released in Mexico City, precisely to cause a public reaction where people and lawmakers would then demand global vaccinations. Those vaccines, in turn, would be intentionally laced with live flu virus samples designed to kill a large number of people and reduce the global population. All the deaths, of course, could be blamed on the virus. And the drug companies would, guess what, get rich in the process. The big pharma profit theory. Swine flu vaccines are being pushed globally in order to funnel more profits into the hands of drug companies. And the more people get sick from the live attenuated viruses in the vaccines, the more repeat business the drug companies make from the sick patients. The chemtrail vaccine binary poison theory. Chemtrails have exposed the populations in major world cities to the first half of a binary poison. The mandatory swine flu vaccine will complete that binary recipe, poisoning people with another seemingly innocent cocktail of chemicals that just happens to combine with the chemtrail poisons and result in widespread death. The do-gooder theory. This is a favorite theory of doctors, drug company reps, and public health authorities. All those conspiracy theories are bunk. These vaccines are being forced on you for your own good by an industry that cares about people and only has your best interest in mind. Profits and power have nothing to do with it. Your government is trying to protect you. Didn't you know? 99% of the U.S. population believes the do-gooder theory, and they will gladly allow themselves to be injected with anything the government recommends, especially if people stop dropping dead this fall and the population can be scared into lining up for swine flu shots. The upshot of all this is that 99% of the people will then be carrying live, attenuated swine flu genetic materials in their blood, creating the perfect opportunity for further recombining with seasonal flu. Global mandatory swine flu vaccinations will in fact create a population of infected swine flu carriers. Some of them will die in the 48 hours following the injection. Most will manage to survive the shots and go on to become carriers of swine flu genetic material. With their immune systems weakened by vaccine chemicals and processed, nutrient-depleted junk foods, they will serve as walking incubator vessels for the next sweeping strain of influenza. And no matter what happens, or no matter what the theory, Big Pharma makes money. The more people die, the more power the government is able to grab through vaccine mandates, forced quarantines, declarations of martial law, and other similar measures. A pandemic is the perfect opportunity to destroy whatever remaining freedoms the American people still cling to. My advice, be prepared to protect yourself from the coming wave of gunpoint medicine. Both your health and your freedoms may soon be at stake. Keep reading Natural News for more information on how to protect yourself from not only swine flu, but also your own government's ill-conceived swine flu vaccination mandates. As this situation unfolds for the fall of 2009, we'll post more information about what you can do to protect your health freedoms from the global pharmaceutical machine that wants to inject you with live attenuated influenza. And this is from naturalnews.com. And you can go to their website and read what you can do to protect yourself.
Yeah. And Pretty nasty business out there, I tell you.
Very nasty business.
Very nasty. And, you know, the crazy thing is though, the pharmaceuticals are all involved with this thing. I mean, they're creating their own demise, all right? Because the more people you kill, the less people are going to buy your products. You know what I mean?
They're only living in the moment.
Totally in the moment. I mean, totally. Like, if you kill if they kill off all these people, I mean, there goes their profits. You know, you can't sell them a little aspirin anymore. But anyway, some good news here. It's interesting news I got the other day. In fact, it's from IsraeliNationalNews.com.
Mm.
And very interesting. It says EU, which is
European Union,
accept PA, or Palestinian Authority State, as full member of the UN.
That's what they're recommending?
Yeah.
Excuse me.
IsraeliNationalNews.com. Okay. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Xavier Solana is taking steps to move the establishment of the Palestinian Authority State through the United Nations, whether Israel agrees to it or not. Solana told a British audience in London on Saturday that Israel and the Palestinian Authority should be given a deadline by which to conclude negotiations of a two-state solution. If a final status agreement is not reached by that time, according to the Reuters news agency, Solana recommended that one be imposed by the United Nations instead. After a fixed deadline, a UN Security Council resolution would proclaim the adoption of the two-state resolution, or the two-state solution. He said it would accept the Palestinian state as a full member of the UN and set a calendar for implementation. It would mandate the resolution of other remaining territorial disputes and legitimize the end of the claims. He added, if the parties are not able to stick to it, referring to the UN-imposed timetable, then a solution backed by the international community should be put on the table. Solana added that the UN-imposed two-state solution should include resolutions of issues such as control over Israel's capital, the city of Jerusalem, as well as the border definitions, securing arrangements at the right of return by millions of foreign dissidents, of Arab refugees who abandoned their homes during the 1948 war. And the Palestinian Authority negotiator, Siab Erkat, reiterated Sunday that no discussions between the Palestinian Authority and Israel would begin without a complete freeze of all Jewish construction of Judea Samaria. And Ikrat stated that the statement in response to a call by Prime Minister Netanyahu to resume peace talks with Israel. There can be no compromises on construction, Ikat said. If Israel is allowed to build 1,000 or 2,000 units, it will lead to the Palestinian Authority, the Arab nations, to believe the U.S. government cannot convince the Israeli government to stop building. And the Palestinian Authority chairman, Mahmoud Abbas, has said repeatedly, he is unwilling to come to the table unless Israel stops the building in the regions, including construction within the city limits of existing cities and towns. And the only interesting thing about that is that the Palestinian Authority is not an elected or representative of the government, of the people of Palestine.
Yeah, they've elected.
Hamas is the elected officials.
Believe it or not, they were democratically elected.
That's right. So, you know, the majority of Palestinians voted for Hamas. So I think you're jumping the gun on this thing, but, you know, good, bad, or I don't know if it's good or bad. But
I don't either.
At least it might raise some, it'll raise the stakes a little bit more and give the Palestinians a little more
I'm going to give them some hope.
Yeah, you know, that their plight will be recognized. And why don't you read that one?
Your credit card company, and this is from consumerist.com, Your credit card company is building a psychological profile of you. I'm sure they're doing that already. The next time you apply for a credit card, your credit report and income will only be part of the criteria used to determine your credit worthiness. For that matter, as long as you have had the card, what you use it for will be noted and added to a growing set of data that makes up your psychological profile, which will then be referred to every time the bank deals with you or reevaluates your risk as a customer. The New York Times Magazine takes a look at this new method of determining credit risk, pioneered by Canadian tire executive J.P. Martin 6 years ago. Martin's measurements were so precise that he could tell you the riskiest drinking establishment in Canada, Shark's Pool Bar in Montreal, where 47% of the patrons who used their Canadian Tire card missed 4 payments over 12 months. He could also tell you the safest products, premium birdseed and a device called the snow roof rake that homeowners use to remove high up snowdrifts so they don't fall on pedestrians. It's not just what you buy reflects your socioeconomic level and current financial status, however. What Martin did was take the raw data and tease out personality traits that explained the purchases while predicting future behavior. Why did birdseed and snow rake buyers pay off their debts? The answer research indicated was that those consumers felt a sense of responsibility toward the world manifested in their spending on birds they didn't own and the pedestrians they might not know. Why were felt pad buyers so understanding? Why were felt pad buyers so upstanding? Because they wanted to protect their belongings, be they hardwood floors or credit cards or credit scores. Why did chrome skull owners skip out on their debts? The person who buys a skull for their car, they are like people who go to a bar named Sharks, Mark said. Would you give them a loan? Lenders have been using this sort of data mining ever since, but until recently they've kept it on a down low to avoid triggering any privacy fears from customers. Now, with billions of dollars of losses from formerly profitable customers who suddenly can't pay, the lenders are using their psychological data not only to screen for the right sort of customers, but to also try to convince the bad ones to pay off their debts. There's another reason for this, too. It helps build stronger relationships with the customer. I'm going to ask Leo to read this next paragraph because the printing is just so small I can't see it. That's what I was having trouble.
Okay, there's another reason, yeah. If a credit card company detects unsettling patterns, it might start cutting credit lines, raising interest rates, or accelerating repayment schedules.
Okay.
Companies are expected to withdraw $2.7 trillion of credit by the end of 2010, according to a March report from the Meredith Whitney Advisory Group, a banking analyst firm. But the most useful information the card companies are deriving from their data are the insights that help them deepen their relationship with customers. Didn't you just read this? Anyway.
No, I didn't read that.
Particularly where the cardholder is going through a rough time. One of the strongest conclusions of the psychological studies is that the cardholders are most likely to pay the bills of those companies with which they have an emotional connection. Okay. So you can check this out. What does your credit card company know about you, New York Times Magazine? And that's on the consumerist.com.
I think they have a lot of information already on us. This is a very good article. The print on this is also small, Leo. I didn't know whether you had time to read that. I thought it was a pretty good article. Can you see it? Some of the print is small on these.
It's long.
Let me see if I can find something that's a little shorter.
I'll read a little bit of what I can.
Yeah, read a little bit of it.
Gore, the U.S. climate bill will help bring about global governance.
That's why I wanted to just read a little bit of that anyway. You'll get the gist.
This is from climatedepot.com. And Former Vice President Al Gore declared the Congressional Climate Bill will help bring about global governance. I bring you good news from the U.S., Gore said on July 7, 2009, in Oxford at the Smith School World Forum on Enterprise and Environment, sponsored by UK Times. Just 2 weeks ago, the House of Representatives passed a Waxley-Markey climate bill, where it said, in noting it was very much a step in the right direction. President Obama has pushed for the passage of the bill in the Senate and attended a G8 summit this week, where he agreed to attempt to give the Earth's temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees. It's a lot of bullshit, okay, and we're going to get taxed. And they're headed for world governance. That's what they want over this.
That's the point I wanted to make.
And giving authority to the UN and giving authority to some elite powers. And Gore is a traitor. You know, there's no doubt about it in my mind. He's a globalist traitorous bastard. All right, and the guy should be hung up by his nose. You know, I mean, this is what this guy is.
Yeah, I don't like it.
Really, I mean, the guy's a joke. He's
sold us out.
Joke, sellout.
Yeah.
And it's like Kerry is a sellout, and every damn Democrat we've ever seen is a sellout, and every Republican is a crook.
Yeah.
And it's like God Almighty, man, you can't get a break in this town. You can't get a break in this country here. It's just it gets worse and worse. So
well,
if ever you see anything more on this global unity crap. Climate bill. Just keep reading on, and you'll see some dreadful things.
Get your representatives to vote against it.
As governments, I mean, it's world government, you know, and that's all it is. So, you know, take it for that, guys.
And I just wanted to mention the Doomsday Report. More change from the Obama administration: forced abortions, mass sterilization. A planetary regime with the power of life and death over American citizens. The tyrannical fantasies of a madman are merely the opinion of a person now in control of science policy in the United States, or both. These ideas, among many others equally horrifying recommendations, were put forth by John Holdren, whom Barack Obama has recently appointed director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy, assistant to the President for Science and Technology and co-chair of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, informally known in the United States as ScienceSAR. In a book Holdren co-authored in 1977, the man now firmly in control of science policy in this country wrote that, number one, women could be forced to abort their pregnancies whether they wanted to or not. The population at large could be sterilized by infertility drugs intentionally put into the nation's drinking water or in food. Single mothers and teen mothers should have their babies seized from them against their will and given away to other couples to raise. People who contribute to social deterioration can be required by law to exercise reproductive responsibility. In other words, be compelled to have abortions or be sterilized. A transnational planetary regime should assume control of the global economy and also dictate the most intimate details of American lives using an armed international police force. The above was taken from this page, which is a post inspired from this article. I suggest reading the post in its entirety as it contains scans of pages of the book, in order to properly quote Holdren. So that's important. Reading some or all of the author's conclusions, suggestions, is just scary, plain, and simple. How someone with these radical views came into such a position of power within a political system is equally as scary. Is this the change everyone voted for? It certainly doesn't look like it, with Obama's approval rating dropping to 51%, down from a high of 65 and falling steadily. It seems the more people find out about their chosen one, the less they like him. Also, this is just anecdotal, but this is the only president I know that people in the United States are actually scared of, literally scared. We've had other presidents that were either poor leaders or appeared to be stupid, or people who just didn't like for whatever reason. but I've never talked to so many people who are scared of their own president.
No, that's so real, and we are as well. I mean, we are both.
This makes me a little nervous.
You know, what's going on, and the problem is that you have no watchdogs at this point. You have no.
When you're in policy czar, you don't answer to anybody but the president.
And you're not vetted. You're not
screened.
You're not screened by Congress.
You can't get fired by Congress.
No. The only person that can fire you is the guy who hired you, which is the president. You work directly for him. So it's like, you can, these guys could be spies. These guys could be murderers. These guys could be
anything.
So what
they're doing is circumventing the system to do exactly what they feel like doing.
That's right. So it's like.
Why have Congress?
I mean, we thought Bush was bad, and Bush was horrible. Bush was horrible. But this guy, but what Bush did...
And Clinton before him was terrible.
But what those guys did paved the way for this administration to take, to be doing some weird, weird, funky crap. And we're going to get...
People that he's appointed, I'm not
horrible
with
people.
At all.
Rahm Emanuel, you know...
Starting
Axelrod,
right off.
You know, Riggs. This guy, Czar. Sotomayor. I mean, all of these god-awful appointments... are just horrendous, and we're seeing the results. Geithner in the Treasury, a horrible, horrible, horrible man, as well as Sumner and all of these advisors, and Hank Paulson still lurking around, and Goldman Sachs people.
Rising to the top yet again.
Shit floats.
Brzezinski.
Yeah, you know, that's exactly what's going on. You know, crap floats, and it's floating all over the place in the Obama government. So, you know, we got to really take a look at what's going on, folks.
We didn't support Bush, but that doesn't mean we were going to support a Democrat if he didn't do things
if
the way he should.
Know what he said. Yeah, I mean, we don't blindly follow anybody, but we had little choice again, and unfortunately, we may have all gotten hoodwinked with this guy. And,
not everyone.
No, not everyone, but. Unfortunately, I think this doesn't look good. But anyway, we've got an interview that changed the subject a little bit. I don't know if we got anything else that's important to read.
No, those were the most important things, I thought.
And we have an interview with
Dr. Marty Horowitz, A Pursuit of Happiness.
And we're gonna play that now. And I hope you enjoy it. It's about half an hour long. And it was pretty good.
Yeah,
and
you might consider buying his book.
Happiness.
It's a good book,
Course
I think.
And Happiness.
Yeah, it's a very good book, and it can open your eyes and maybe help you lead a better life.
Check it out, and we're going to play that interview now.
So here it comes.
Yeah. Right about now.
Horowitz, M.D., A Course in Happiness, Mastering the Three Levels of Self-Understanding That Leads to True and Lasting Contentment. And this book is quite a book. I didn't get to read the whole book, but I've read quite a bit of it, and I'm going to go back and read more. A Course in Happiness ensures that happiness can be achieved by anyone, even those who can't afford traditional therapy. And that's what Dr. Horowitz shares. It's a valuable tool for a better life.
I'm going to get him on the line.
Okay, go ahead. He's a practicing psychiatrist for over 40 years. He's a professor of psychiatry at the University of California, San Francisco, as well as director of the Center of Stress and Personality at the Langley Porter Psychiatric Institute. He is the recipient of two MacArthur Fellowship Awards, and his work on self, stress, trauma, and mourning has been featured in Time Magazine, the New York Times, as well as on CBS, NBC, ABC, and the National Public Radio of Canada.
Hello.
Dr. Horowitz lives in San Francisco. He enjoys reading, writing, and reflecting, as well as being outdoors with companions. And what does it say on the jacket of this book? He says, A Course in Happiness offers a roadmap for achieving true and lasting contentment.
I think it's your facts there or something.
This insightful, well-written, and practical book presents readers with the tools they need to change their lives. Because for most people, happiness does not come easily. It can take a lot of hard work and study. And that's what it says on the jacket. Maybe it's time you took a course in happiness. That's really kind of cute. And on the cover is a little red balloon with a string on it. Yeah, and we have Dr. Horowitz on the phone. Welcome to the show, Dr. Horowitz.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, well, everybody wants to be happy, right?
I think pretty much everyone does.
And so you've given us, in your book, you've given us a roadmap with signposts how to become happy, the three levels for understanding that lead to true and lasting contentment.
I wanted to ask you one question that I posed in my mind when I read this was that is there really anybody, being a psychiatrist, you would know, are there people that thrive on being unhappy?
So there must be some obstacles to being happy for people.
I mean, are there people that get off by being unhappy? I mean, are they, you know, that is their happiness or what?
Well, in a way, if they think they're either getting even with themselves or showing somebody how unhappy they are, it can have a function of having some kind of morbid satisfaction. But those are people that are pretty few and far between.
But you know the type that are always grumbling about the weather, grumbling about, you know, whatever it is.
Complaining is one route to happiness. People complain, and it brings them closer together because they share the annoyance.
Oh, okay.
So what do you think for the average person, what gets in the way of them being happy?
Well, the kind of things I'm addressing in the book are obstacles that are enduring, kind of as dysfunctional beliefs, and obstacles that are enduring as excessive feelings of entitlement, obstacles such as feeling that the self is degraded in some way and so cannot seek success. So the book is a series of lessons and teaching points that try and help people identify by thinking calmly and clearly.
Mm-hmm.
About a variety of topics that are in each of the 10 chapters. What are their values? What are their goals, concepts, and what are the obstacles?
Okay.
Now, did you come to this course in happiness more through your personal experiences or through your practice because you're a psychiatrist or a combination of both?
Both.
Mm-hmm.
Both. I feel, in a way, enough self-confidence to use myself as an instrument for teaching other people, so I do present my own triumphs and tragedies. And because I think that an amplitude of stories makes the kind of hard work of doing the lessons I propose more understandable and also gives a feeling of optimism,
mm-hmm.
of you know, certain shared things about the human predicament, and that with courage and stamina, we can often get through them and have contentment.
Well, I find that just going through the book here, and if you the three stages that are, or the three levels, I guess, of understanding, and one is integration, and finding all the facets of self, the importance of self-reflection, and using stress for personal growth. How do you find people that successfully integrate these aspects of their lives that, like for instance, if they had a rotten childhood, all right, and were you know, an abusive childhood, how do they come to terms with that later in life, you know, like as an adult, you know, as an early adult, and then later as a you know, a mature adult.
Well, especially in middle adulthood, people, especially over 30, seem to have acquired new abilities of mind, and they can kind of realign their life narrative, and they can go back through the frames of past, present, and near future, and kind of align how their near future expectations can be revised so that they're not always clouded by the grievances.
Would that, if someone's had a severe abuse in their childhood, that would really require professional help, wouldn't you think?
I don't think so.
You don't think so?
No, it may. I mean, obviously, if a person has tried to to adapt to it and intuitively feels like they're not making progress, then professional help is certainly indicated. But many people have a traumatic childhood or losses of their parents in adolescence and things like that. That doesn't mean they're happy memories, but they've learned to cope with them, and they've also learned a certain amount of self-confidence. So they've people who have been treated like princes and princesses may have more trouble in adulthood than people who have had more common pitfalls and found that they can kind of slog through.
Well, here's another example I was thinking about, which was post-traumatic stress syndrome. You take a person who's suffered a massive accident or has been in war or has seen their family murdered or something to that effect, but or even themselves have been beat up or mugged or something, where it causes them traumatic stress. What would how are they
overcome?
Yeah, how do they overcome this hurt on them? You know, you always hear, "Oh, forgive and forget and forgive and whatnot." And man, that's one of the hardest things in the world to do.
Yes, forgive is a good motto, but it's hard to achieve and sometimes impossible.
Yeah.
And one has to move on anyway. But trauma, of course, is what led me into the book, because it was our group at University of California, San Francisco, that developed the criterion in brief treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we've studied those for a good many decades, and the question is, how do people not only get through it to master it, but how do they get some kind of growth afterwards, called post-traumatic growth? And the answer is they go through a rather slow process. Take mourning, for example. If someone loses a beloved spouse, one's not going to mourn that in 2 or 3 weeks. It's going to take months. And but something happens during that process, which is a gradual change in how the bad news relates to personal identity and to the opportunity for new relationships in the future.
Well, I know, and you made in your introduction, you spoke about your deep loss where you lost your wife. Now, how long did it take to recover from that? I mean, that was a horrendous, a very hard thing to do. And to get through, and, you know, how did you feel you grew from that?
Well, first, my wife and I went through it together.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a couple of years knowing what the end was going to be and about when it was going to be. In fact, it was a little longer life than we thought. But we were very comfortable with sharing, and the beginning of this book was in that process. That is, she was already editing some of the first writing of some of the chapters, and she felt that the book, in part, would be our legacy of the incident we had, and her work would be kind of a legacy for our kids to read the lessons. And so while we went through grief and suffering together, as I say in the book, we also were happy, not every second, certainly not.
Mm-hmm.
Frightened at 3 a.m. in the morning is not the best time for these things. But we did have moments of happiness up to the very end, because we had a very long-range view of what that was and what our life had been. And she was busily writing out instructions for me what my life should be afterwards.
Yeah.
And so there were letters for each of the kids. And
yeah.
So it's seeing...
So that was planned more. I mean, it was foreseen, as opposed to somebody who dies in a car accident or a plane crash or something.
Right. And foreseeing it makes it easily. For example, some of the research that we've done that leads to the lessons in the book involved a study of widows and widowers.
Right.
Before I became one. And
right.
Many people think that's going to be harder if you're anticipating it because of all that pain and suffering, but it's not. The more there's time for anticipation, the less distress later on. And the more you've had previous experiences, the sooner one can get through. So older people, while it's a terrific loss, let's say, of a spouse, they do get through it better than, let's say, someone in their 30s who loses a spouse in a sudden car crash.
Okay. Well, and that's also out of order when people shouldn't, we have the notion that people shouldn't die when they're young like that.
Right, right.
So it's sort of against our way, it just shouldn't happen that way, and that must be very difficult to adjust to.
I think you know, just as a note here, the first loss I ever lost, well, aside from my dog, was my grandfather, who I was very close to. But at age 11, that was the first great loss, okay, that I had to experience, and it took me a number of years to accept that, you know.
Yes.
As a kid, and of course I, you know, accepted it later on, but I'd say it took me at least 2 or 3 years before I could even try to understand what happened there.
Right. Well, the work is going on all the time.
Yeah.
Of understanding it, but in the later phases, it becomes a much more conscious understanding.
Are kids more? Can kids be more? Are they more adaptable than adults to the loss of a loved one or loss of somebody close?
I think people sometimes think so for the wrong reasons,
mm-hmm.
which is as adults, after a loss, we're going to go through day after day of sorrow.
Right.
And kids may go out and play an hour later, and so some people think, well, they don't care, but they just have different cycles of states of mind.
Well, you think about this Michael Jackson loss here, where he's got three kids that are orphaned now. So what would the, do you think that this was a proper way of grieving to have 50,000 people in an arena and have them stand up there and announce? I don't know, it just seemed kind of bizarre, you know, a grandstanding there, if they, you know, the whole family is standing on a stage, you know, giving tribute to Michael and the little kid breaking down, you know, that kind of thing. To me, that was a little bit over the top, but, you know. I mean, what, as a psychiatrist, was that good for the kids?
Well, I wouldn't comment on this particular one because
yeah.
I don't know the people involved closely, but I'd say in general that when a child has a loss, let's say 5, 6, 7 years old, they remember it.
Mm-hmm.
For all the events surrounding them.
Yeah.
And then as you talk with them, if you have the chance, over what you do with some friends and acquaintances and relatives, over when they're 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, the memories change.
Mm-hmm.
And what also changes in addition to the memories is what it means to the self, and what it means to the self in different contexts of other relationships that are ongoing or even in the future. And so a major loss, like the loss of a parent as a child, the relationship with the parent and the relationship with the loss and the relationship with the absence of the parent and the relationship with the replacement parents, all that goes on for a whole lifetime. It's in the mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal of the kind of long-range work that I try and suggest by the lessons and teaching points in the book is to bring those different kind of encapsulations into harmony.
Mm-hmm.
And that requires some conscious contemplation, maybe even some writing in a journal, and taking on some of the obstacles that have earlier, when the person didn't feel safe to go through the sorrow or loneliness. When a person does feel safe and encounters these things in with kind of a clear, lucid lens, then new meanings kind of can be braided together, and the person feels much more on their own path in life and much more effective in being ready to cope with things in the future while really enjoying, I don't know, the smell of the roses, the sounds of the music, the sun on the shoulders, togetherness with other people.
What do you think are the, what do you think interferes with happy relationships? What do you think are the primary problems?
Well, I think there's a lot of problems, but two I deal with sort of later in the book, because I think the reader's then ready from the earlier lessons, is lapses of one's own behavior, where one feels remorse
mm-hmm.
for things one has done, or very often one has not done. And that often, that review of lapses often involves also a kind of very adult confrontation with one's own personal values, deeply emotionally held values, kind of raised to or review so they get sorted out. Most people's conflicts aren't between good and bad. I mean, with other people, one can feel they're bad and we're good. But within oneself, it's usually a competition between two goods, and which one was a better good. And we're always struggling with dilemmas of which good thing to serve.
Well, that's another question. As far as competition with others, all right, if you're competing in some way, you know, with others, that's a cause for unhappiness in a lot of people. You know, keeping up with the Joneses, keeping up with the status, keeping up with whatever it may be. It seems to be rather a hollow pursuit, but nevertheless, it seems to be one that dominates American society as well as European society, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean with taking the opportunity to sort personal values and personal values.
Right.
This is something that mom said you ought to do,
mm-hmm.
that you don't necessarily agree on when you consider it.
Well, it's like you know people that can't stand other people getting ahead, can't stand good things happening to other people. That, you know, they get very jealous, or they get very, how are you doing, you know, that kind of thing. And
right.
You know,
with a number of the examples in the book, because
yeah.
you're right on target, that is a common obstacle. So instead of enjoying the achievements of kind of civilization, people are jealous because they weren't the one who wrote the great symphony or painted.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And that can, and if people really hold that and dwell on it, it can cause terrible health issues in people. People become very sick.
And I've known people that have, you know, that have actually gotten mentally unbalanced over their regrets that they, you know, like you said, they didn't create, they should have, but they didn't create the great symphony, you know.
Right.
Or they went to the finest schools, but they didn't achieve what they had wanted to achieve, you know, that kind of thing. And it really affected them later in their life, much later in their life, of course, you know.
Well, I deal with some of the troubles of later life, which I've reserved kind of towards the end of the book.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm emphasizing is resorting things out earlier.
Mm-hmm.
While there's a sense of a future where there can be acts of remorse to make up for things, there can be a realignment of the kind of the tension arc between overly ideal expectations and what one really wants to do. I mean, many celebrities get into grave difficulties because they have had really enormous success in the eyes of others, but they haven't anticipated that others are still envious and jealous and undercutting of them, and that they still have ideas of entitlement to continued success while other rivals are coming along. But also they tend to ignore relationships and the work that it takes to develop depth and continuity and richness and intimacy.
But it makes it. But it, as far as what I can see, what I've seen as far as people in the limelight, that it's a very difficult career, and it's an up down career constantly, and they have to keep working to get to stay in that limelight,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and they got to go through those stages of cosmetic surgery or, you know, new publicists or whatever they have to go through.
They have to work,
you know,
hard to stay on top, that's
for sure.
You got
to work real hard to stay there. So, you know, and it's so very easy for them to fall down. And you know, you can just by watching Celebrity Rehab, you can see what happens to so many.
Right. Well, I think that's where stories help and why I've tried to have a lot in the book,
mm-hmm.
as well as the theoretical points and the teaching points and the lessons, which is, it's kind of, we all need a little bit of a mirror, a little distance from ourselves in order to reflect on ourselves and begin to see where we have some intuitive values, but then when we really try and put them into words, we find that they may be somewhat dysfunctional, the intuitions of what would be the right thing for us to get in order to be happy, rather than attempting to be more positive and more realistic and kind of, you know, seize the moment and be in the present moment and take what it has to offer and to find a good balance between self-centeredness and relatedness to others.
Do you think it's a difficult thing to be happy in this society, in the culture that we live in?
Well, actually, you know, I think we live in a terrific culture. I don't think it's ideal,
mm-hmm.
And I think it's too materialistic and desperate for money, but the opportunities are, compared to everything else, realistically fantastic and pretty supportive. So society is constantly changing, but as I read history, I see things as, in spite of all the terrible wars and terrible bloodshed and so forth, by and large, the lot of the average person, I think, has improved. There's less tyranny.
Mm-hmm. Well,
that's good to hear. Most people not speaking that way, saying that, you know, our society is very materialistic, as you did say, but the pressures on people to buy and purchase that we get through the media sometimes can be very overwhelming.
Yeah.
And that causes a great dissatisfaction among people.
The media will use the psychology of what gets attention. And I mean, everyone is pretty clear on what gets attention. It's sex and violence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's trauma. And so, and the only pleasure in the trauma is that someone else is experiencing, and it's a fictional thing, hopefully. And of course, then all the news with the economic thing has emphasized greed.
Right.
And really irrational thinking. So there's been various political and financial disasters from people who were so blinded by idealistic and somewhat greedy hopes that they ignored the possibilities for the catastrophe that come on some people, where they've lost their pensions and that kind of thing.
You know, I wanted to ask you this because for some reason I find myself not... I want to say that I have no regrets. Yeah, everybody wants to say that. I have no regrets. Yeah, you ever have any regrets? Nah, no regrets. You know, you do. You can't help but have regrets.
Anyone who says they have no regrets is probably avoiding some.
I would think so. No,
is in deep denial. Wouldn't you say?
I think the point is to face them calmly and to think them through, and that's why I do devote a long chapter to regrets.
It's such a thing. I mean, especially as you get older, and you have so many regrets. You have to face your whole life, you know, at a certain age, and realize, well, gee, I can't be a long distance runner anymore.
Right, but there still are sources of pride and getting respect from other people in terms of having, I guess I'd call them virtues, like courage.
Mm-hmm.
And in the face of, let's say, disability.
Well, I'm just saying age, you know. I mean, it's like you're not going to see an 80-year-old guy in a marathon, you know. In the Olympics.
Well, one of the examples I use in the book is of a surgeon who developed macular degeneration.
Wow.
He was thinking of retirement, but he really had to retire.
Right.
When he couldn't see well enough. And he had a plan for what he would do when he would retire, which was to help his wife with her activity of raising and breeding dogs.
Oh.
And vision didn't count too terribly for that. And but he was sort of seeing that as kind of an extended vacation. And retirement isn't an extended vacation, or at least it wasn't for him.
Did he actually go blind, or did he have some...
He lost his fine-tuned vision, so
he couldn't
read.
Uh-huh.
But he could, you know, get about, see larger shapes, so he could do things. So it was important for him to reframe what he was going to do. Well, that'd be quite individual, but he decided to go back in the way to the medical center and attend lectures and be available for younger colleagues to talk to him, even though he was no longer a surgeon. And he sort of regained his self-image and his pride as he began to see. He was doing very well with the deck of cards that he now was having to play with. And so it's that kind of revision of realistic things. Rather than taking on a very catastrophic scenario,
mm-hmm.
this is the end of my life, I ought to commit suicide, or a very idealistic thing, you know, I will take up this or that, and then I'll just feel like a stud again or something like that. So it's realistic in between idealization and catastrophe that I'm emphasizing again and again in the lesson.
So what you're really saying is facing yourself and life as it is, not how you'd really like it to be.
Right. It's important to define what you'd like it to be. I mean, in fact, that's one of the methods I do in one of the lessons I call the three scenarios method, which is you can start with what you'd really like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the streets are paved with gold and people find me enormously attractive and think I'm brilliant. And students, you know, have awe and respect and so forth and so on. And then you go to the catastrophic scenario, which is I no longer can teach well. They think I'm an embarrassment. And and so forth. And then you say, okay, now those are the fantastic extremes. What's the middle ground now that's more realistic? And by having those fantastic things pretty clearly stated, suddenly the middle ground kind of comes into focus, like when you focus a camera lens, and you can see much more clearly what lies ahead when you've identified what probably doesn't lie ahead.
One of the greatest problems that I think anybody would face is hatred. Okay, when you absolutely hate something or someone, all right? Over the years, I've managed to live through that, get through it. Okay, but you know, there's a point in your life when something will happen, and you absolutely either hate the person, you're betrayed, or you're abused, or you're beat up, or whatever happens, and you wind up hating somebody or hating something. And how do you get rid of that? I mean, I've had memories 20 years later, okay, of certain things that infuriated me.
Those things do endure in memory, and they do come back.
Yeah.
And in a way, the relationship with the person that you hate lives on in your mind. And and saying forget it or saying forgive are both, for extreme instances, rather possible.
Well, it's like.
But you do.
Yeah.
You do. There are routes to getting to not exactly accepting what happened as inevitable, but accepting that it did happen, as you've now interpreted it realistically to be, and saying, now what are you going to do about it?
Yeah.
And
well, that's where you get the Columbines. That's where you get these people that, they've been extremely bullied, or they're doing extremely, thing that set them off. And they go after revenge thing.
It's very common, and it's very common in post-traumatic disorders, revenge.
Yeah. Well, we had a guy up here a couple years back, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, that maybe even longer, but he worked at the lottery center, and he came in one day, and he shot 4 people, all right? This was in the state of Connecticut, and... He was just furious with the whole place. He got extremely angry and felt he was being he started getting paranoid about things, and then he just came in and shot everybody in front of him. Obviously that's an extreme case, but nevertheless you're seeing more and more of this over the years, and that this hatred builds up in people, and they just go in all out vengeance, you know. How can you quell that, or how do you explain that?
Common instances, road rage.
Yeah.
Mm.
And belittling other people at work.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think, in order to, take a long-range pursuit of contentment, mm-hmm. one does need some periods of calm solitude in order to process some of the anger that everyone's going to feel. With frustrations and to examine what the source is. And that is, what is the frustration? What is the mismatch between what happened and what one thought was going to happen? And to go back and forth over that in ways that we can't go into briefly, but that there are ways for, the everyday rage that we feel and how to take it away from a kind of repetitive, a tape loop of seeking revenge, and how enjoyable that would be, how strong that would make us feel,
right.
Mm-hmm.
And to realize that we're using some of those anger and revenge motives in order to feel strong, because we're afraid of feeling weak, because we couldn't have the road all to ourselves when we wished it.
Yeah, right.
Well, we're almost to the end of our show. Is there one word that you would pass on to our listeners that would be helpful to them to achieve happiness?
Well, I think, I end the book with 10 things, and mm-hmm. The 10th one I have in there is to enjoy the flow of generations. To find the good in having had ancestors that brought you into the world, and think about your legacy and what you're leaving behind. Not necessarily just your children, you may not have children, but, did you plant a tree? Did you write a poem? Did you
build a business? Did you,
teach
a class?
Right.
Right.
Or even, were you a good friend?
Or a decent
friend to someone.
Or a decent person, yeah. yeah, that you have that legacy. But I suppose that's...
Those things are very important. I really appreciated your book, and I hope that a lot of people read it. And
well, I sure hope so.
Yeah, and I hope they buy it. And
of course, and happiness.
Yeah. I think it's very useful for all of us, and it's a great way of looking at life and coming to terms with yourself.
Yeah.
And that's important for all of us.
Yeah, it's called A Course in Happiness. Do you have a website? For this book,
it's my name, which is like Mardi Gras, MardiHorowitz.com.
Mm-hmm.
Penguin has a website, and they have a videotape of stuff related to it.
Okay.
And Barnes & Noble, Amazon, Kindle all have editions.
All right, great.
Well, we hope you sell lots and lots of books because it'll contribute to a better world.
I think so. It's A Course in Happiness by Marty Horowitz, and we thank you very much for being on tonight, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon.
Oh, you're welcome. I'll be glad to do it again.
Okay. Well,
thank you very much.
Okay, right. Bye-bye.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
That was Dr. Marty Horowitz, A Course in Happiness.
Yeah.
Something we can all benefit from.
Yes. So.
And we're right to the end of our show. I can't believe it.
Yeah, check.
Good. I want to thank everybody for joining us. Ran a little late there for those of you who were cut off. We want to welcome you to tomorrow night's show. When we talk about spirituality and we delve into a few works by some fascinating people. And then we're going to, Friday night, we have Friday Night with George Dixon, and we'll continue our discussions on the Mayan calendar and the end time prophecies and talk a bit about what that means. So join us on Friday and Thursday, and thank you for joining us tonight, and have a pleasant evening.